am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center and your host. As many of you know, and there are a great many of you on the phone today, the JPC is a 501c3 nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defenses. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity, two things we're really pushing this season. This is the first JPC webinar of the fall 2020 season. In the spring and summer, we brought you some really outstanding speakers, Richard Goldberg on snapback sanctions, award-winning journalist Claudia Rosette on the Hong Kong uprising, Daniel Blumenthal, one of America's premier China hands, on China's initial response to the Wuhan virus and China's broader goals. Dan, by the way, will be back with us later this month. Watch your emails. IDF Reserve Brigadier General Asaf Orion on the U.S.-Israel security relationship and the changes that each country is undergoing as in its relations with China. Scholar of Islam Harold Rode on Turkey's determination to enhance the Islamization of Jerusalem. We've had Ilya Shapiro, Jonathan Schanzer, Doug Fife, Michael Duran, and more. And we promise no less for the fall season. In our great eight-month-old tradition, we are bringing you another outstanding guest today, IDF Reserve Brigadier General Yossi Cooperwasser of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. He is also the head of, wait for this, the Institute for Research of Intelligence Methodology at the Israeli Intelligence Community Commemoration and Heritage Center. It's a huge mouthful, and I say it all because it's very important, number one. It's also a terrific place to visit when you next get to Israel, and I hope some of us or many of us will get to Israel in the coming year, or look it up online. It's a great resource. He is actively involved in organizations that support Israel and those that fight against anti-Semitism and anti-Israel initiatives. Cooper, as he is better known, was the former director of the Ministry of International Affairs and Strategy. He served as assistant defense attaché for intelligence at the Israeli embassy in Washington, intelligence officer for the IDF Central Command. I think that's where we first met many, many years ago, and held senior positions at the IDF Directorate of Military Intelligence, where he's had significant role in determining Israel's methods for coping with terror, as well as regional developments, and sharing analysis with the U.S. and other foreign partners. He's been a contributor to a wide variety of publications, and he appears in various Israeli and international newspapers. We were pleased to have him in the summer issue of In Focus Quarterly. You can read his article there, and all of our publications, Insight Articles, the In Context blog, Alliance Tracker, Frontline Defense, and In Focus on our website at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. That's www.jewishpolicycenter.org. So you will notice that you are muted. That doesn't mean we don't want to hear from you, but we want to hear from you in writing. So if you have questions for our speaker, please send them during the program to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. And I know you will have questions. Israel's agreement with the United Arab Emirates, formerly known as the Abraham Accords, is a tremendous achievement. When Egypt made peace with Israel, when Jordan made peace with Israel, they were met in the Arab world with a cold shoulder. Anwar Sadat paid the ultimate price for visiting Jerusalem. The UAE, on the other hand, seems to be right in the middle of an emerging Gulf state consensus. So with that, Cooper, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Shoshana, and thank you for everybody who's listening. And yes, I think the gist of what I want to say is exactly what you just said.
That,
it's all right. I won't stop at the gist. I'll elaborate on that. So really, this is a different thing that we are experiencing now. It's not the same. Well, every piece is important. Every piece is really exciting. For Israel, who always dreamt of having peace with its neighbors, any kind of progress towards peace, and every peace agreement is something really that makes us feel so elated. But saying that, this peace is a little bit different. And in some respects, this is the game changer we were waiting for so long in our relations with our environment and our neighbors. Because for the first time, this is the most important new attribute to this peace, is for the first time, this is planned in order to be a warm peace. It's not peace that is based on ending some war and we have to give back some land and we have to take upon ourselves all kinds of political decisions that are not difficult to sell at home. This time, it's a very easy sell. Everybody likes it on both sides, not only in Israel, also on the other side. When Egypt made peace with us, everybody boycotted Egypt in the Arab world. And it was sent out of the Arab League for a while. It's, today we are in a totally different and opposite situation. It's, today it's the Palestinians who cannot convince the Arab League to convene in order to discuss this matter. It's definitely not to take any measures against the UAE. This is out of the question. If anybody is going to take steps against the other, it is the Gulf states against the Palestinians, because they are upset with their reaction to the agreement, and the Palestinians have just informed the world yesterday that following everything that's happening, the Arab states have stopped giving them money. Not that they gave them that much before, but they are not giving them anything, because so the onus is now on the Palestinians to prove that they are all behaving themselves and not on the UAE. And definitely not in the Gulf, as Shoshana said, definitely not in the Gulf. In the Gulf, what we hear from people from the Gulf is amazing, really amazing. What we hear from them is that this is the right thing to do. It's not because it was imposed on them. It's they do it because they want to do it. And they expect the Palestinians to do the same, because they are full of criticism of the Palestinians. And they say that, yes, Israel has a right to exist. Israel, the Jewish people is a part of the Middle East. It has its history in the Middle East, its history in the land of Israel. And we should accept it. And the Palestinians should adopt a different approach to the conflict. And yes, they did it also in order to prevent Israel from extending its sovereignty over what they call annexation, over parts of Judea and Samaria and the Jordan Valley, because they want the Palestinians to have a greater chunk of land for their future state. But they expect the Palestinians to accept that on the other parts of the land of Israel, where there's going to be Israel, it's going to be a land that run by the Jewish people. And the Palestinians should understand that there's not going to be any return to these areas by the descendants of the refugees, and to stop this dreaming while awake about the possibility of something like that happening. And these are messages coming from openly from scholars and from politicians in the Gulf states, including from Saudi Arabia, that have not yet made it all the way towards peace like the Emirates, but is moving in this direction. And when Palestinians hear that, they go crazy, because they understand this peace is so different. It's everybody's talking about the cooperation we are going to have, people to people, tolerance, economic opportunities, scientific new peaks that can be reached, all kinds of things that when we had peace in before were never mentioned. When some dreamers like Shimon Peres were speaking about the new Middle East, but most people were very skeptical. And now this is something that is within reach. And this is something really new and important and a game changer in our relations with our neighbors. Now we have to remember, the second issue is not only that it's warm peace, it's going to make it possible for us to achieve one of the basic dreams and strategic goals of Zionism, which is to be integrated into the region. And you know, when Herzl had this wrote his Altneuland, he spoke about the fact that he didn't realize, he never thought that the Arabs would oppose the Zionists when they come. because he thought that, well, the Jews will come and so much prosperity and new opportunities are going to be opened for the Arabs living around them, that they will probably hug those Jews and be very friendly to them. And for the first time after 120 years, finally, the other side realizes that and really wants to make this happen. And it's really up to us. We have to prove that joining hands with us is really fruitful and pays off for those who do that. But I believe we can do that. And once we do that, I think that we shall see more counties coming in and joining up. Of course, not everybody is going to do the same thing that the UAE did, because the preparation of the minds and hearts in the UAE was much greater than in any other place. The UAE was open to Israelis for a long time. The UAE was preaching for tolerance for a long time. So it was easier for us to make it for the UAE to go on board, to come on board, and for easier for us to reach and connect with them. As a matter of fact, I must say that I know very few Israelis who don't have a friend in the UAE. If you don't have a friend in the UAE, something is wrong with you. Immediately, I believe there are going to be all kinds of open cooperation on economic fields and the scientific fields and others. Tourism is going to flourish probably. This is obvious. But so not everybody is in the same stage. But other counties are going to follow suit. And we can expect not necessarily full normalization, but also partial normalization is highly appreciated here. We can appreciate that too. So we see the Sudan, we see Bahrain, we see Oman, and most of all, we see Saudi Arabia. By allowing Israeli flights first to go to Abu Dhabi, and then yesterday they announced they're going to let Israeli flights to fly over Saudi Arabia to wherever they want to fly. And to somebody who flew once from Israel to Australia, I can tell you this is crazy. This is a sea change for Israel, in the understanding that you're not blocked on your eastern side. You can actually cross and go to China, to India, to Australia, to wherever you like. Much shorter, much cheaper. The impact of that on our economic capabilities is going to be immense, in my mind. And it's not, we broke this glass ceiling that prevented us from moving forward. And this is the third issue that I want to speak about, the glass ceiling. For many years, everybody was telling us, listen, you cannot have normal relations with the Arabs unless you succumb to the Palestinian whims of forcing you to go back to, those who know Israel, to go to back to Road 6, which is go back to the 67 lines, and put yourself in extreme danger. Only if you are under extreme danger, you can have normalization with the Arab world. This was the idea behind the Arab Peace Initiative, it's called, but this is a very strange name, because in fact, it was a dictate to Israel how to give up and take upon itself an extremely dangerous situation. And here, we proved that this ceiling was fictional. It wasn't a real ceiling. I was saying that for many years now. And I always believed that this is possible. But most of the time I was laughed at, I must say. And I'm very happy to see that what I preached for a long time is actually happening. Because yes, we can make peace with the Arabs, because the Arabs are, for a long time, not from yesterday, for a long time, they have a much more important issue than the Palestinian issue and where is Israel going to be and where the Palestinians are going to be. The Sunni pragmatic state are fighting against radicalism. That's the most important thing. And Israel has a certain virtue that nobody else has. Israel is the only powerful state in the world that you can rest assured that it will always be on the side of the pragmatists in the battle against the radicals. Not even the United States, who is the second country that can be counted on, is for sure on the side of the pragmatists. The Arabs know that extremely well. 8 years of Obama explained to them extremely well that you cannot rely on the Americans. And the only country you can count on is Israel. And Israel is ready to do whatever is necessary in order to fight radicalism. If it takes some sort of a military move or kinetic attacks on the radicals and developing the capabilities to fight them by developing intelligence capabilities and so on, Israel has it. And Israel is ready to share it with the pragmatic camp. So it's this led the pragmatists to understand that what they need to do is to join hands with Israel. Now, Israel has to be paid for that somehow. It's not that you can just be given all kinds of goodies from the Israelis and give them nothing in return. So the thing that Israel was asking for was normalization, open normalization. And the stars aligned in a certain way in the last couple of months that made it possible for the pragmatists to say, led by the UAE, and the UAE is the most prominent pragmatic country because its mouth is where its money is and where its heart is. And it is ready to fight, and it fights on all the battlefields that the pragmatists are involved in. And because of that, for the UAE, it was clear that they have to be the first to move in that move. And by that, they actually broke this glass ceiling. And this is extremely important because once it's broken, there's no way back. And once it's broken, the direction is just getting more and more developments in the same direction. That I, as I said before, we expect more countries to join in. And the timetable is not clear, but it might be sooner than later in my mind, because all kinds of considerations that have nothing to do with the relations between us and them, but with the way they analyze the situation in the United States before the elections or after the elections. And all these kinds of things can have an impact on how close and how fast they're going to move. So this development is a real game changer in the relationship between Israel and the Arab world. Secondly, it is a game changer in the relations between Israel and the Palestinians. The Palestinians, forever, since 100 years ago, held in their hands two veto powers that were their main assets, with which they prevented any capability to move towards peace that is acceptable to Israel, because they, first of all, had the veto on any agreed upon change in the underground. You cannot make peace. You cannot divide the land without their divide the land in an agreement without their acquiescence. And secondly, they held the veto about normalization. You cannot have normalization with the rest of the Arab world unless you succumb to our demands. And their demands are very clear. They want state in the 67 lines with Jerusalem as its capital, and the right of return accepted by Israel. And they don't have to accept Israel as nation state of the Jewish people. That's the most important element, so that they will continue the struggle against Zionism even after they have a peace agreement. That, because for them, a peace agreement is something in the context of the phases theory, that is just phase one in the full plan of two phases, and then will come the second phase in which they will liberate the rest of the land. That was their demands. And if you don't do that, you cannot reach an agreement, and you cannot have normal relations with the Arabs. What happened in the last year was that those two vetoes were shaken dramatically. First of all, with the peace plan of the US that directly threatened the first veto. We are going to change the situation on the ground with or without you. And that was the issue of extending Israeli sovereignty over 30% of the territories that Israel took in 67. And the Palestinians were extremely afraid that they will lose this veto power. And they have not regained it yet, but it's left in a limbo. And the second thing that was threatened was the veto about normalization. Now, the Palestinians knew that this veto was under threat for a long time now. Abu Mazen, in the last 4 or 5 years, speaks about it again and again and warns the Arabs, don't do that, don't do that. And this creates such a crisis in the Palestinians, because We told them not to do that. We begged them not to do that. And they did it nevertheless. The feeling of failure is doubled. If they, nobody spoke about it, maybe it was just a surprise. But we knew it was coming and we did everything in order to prevent it. And in spite of that, it happened. This is even a bitter, more bitter pill to swallow. And this is where the Palestinians stand today. They lost totally one of their vetoes. And the other one is shaking. And because the issue of extending sovereignty was suspended. The Arabs want to say it was suspended for a very long time, but nobody knows for how long. It depends on so many things. And it depends first and foremost, I would say, on the way the administration wakes up in the morning. Because in the last couple of months, they woke up on the left-hand side, and they actually prevented us from moving forward with the extension of sovereignty. And instead, they gave us a compensation prize, which is the normalization, which is a very good prize. We don't have any complaints. But for the Palestinians, it's a major weakening of their position. They don't have any bargaining chips anymore. In fact, what happened was that whereas before the agreement, the two options that were discussed again and again and again and again by Clinton, by Kerry and Obama, by many others, were either you go back to Road 6 or you stick to the status quo and you pay all kinds of payments for sticking to the status quo. We are going to have cold shoulder attitude towards you. We can from time to time throw you under the bus like we did in Resolution 2334. Of the Security Council that was adopted when Obama was already a lame duck. And we shall punish you for not moving to Road 6. These were the two options that Israel had to look at. Today, the option of moving back to Road 6 is off the table. If there is one option that's off the table, it's not the extension of sovereignty. The option that's off the table is the option of going back to Road 6. And this is what drives the Palestinians crazy, because if this option doesn't exist anymore, then where are they going? And the fact is that it doesn't exist anymore, because no Israeli is going to now move to Road 6 when we already have peace with the Arabs. Why would we move to Road 6? Normalization is already achieved. And the other option is ending the suspension and moving towards extending the sovereignty in the context of the peace plan. The peace plan, as Jared Kushner said yesterday, and he's right, the peace plan is speaking about two states and about Palestinian state as well. But it is speaking about two states for two people, not the Palestinian version of two states living side by side in peace without having any of them dedicated to the Jewish people, because they believe that Jewish people doesn't exist. So there can't be a state for the Jewish people that doesn't exist. No, these are two states for two people, and the Israeli security is guaranteed in our wide variety of security arrangements that guarantee that Israel is going to be safe even if there are two states. That's the kind of arrangement that is left on the table for the Palestinians to decide whether they want to choose it. Even if Biden is elected, I don't believe that Israel is going to all of a sudden say, "Yeah, okay, let's forget it and go back to Road 6." This is, I mean, no Israeli is in favor of that, but with the exception of the Meretz and the Joint Arab List, but it's not in the cards anymore. That's we got rid of this the extremely dangerous suggestion that the Europeans and some elements within the Democratic Party in the United States, and of course some Arabs, and definitely the Palestinians, wanted to push us to. So this is a major change, and the capability of the Palestinians to change it are limited. I won't say zero. They still have all kinds of assets. They are still there. They can resume their struggle, their armed struggle. They can do all kinds of things. I'm not saying that they lost everything. But they lost some major powers that they had. And the important thing about it is that now that they've lost it, there is a greater chance that what the Americans and the Israelis were trying to the message that American and Israeli were trying to convey to the Palestinians throughout the last 4 years, that they have to rethink about their narrative and adopt a narrative that is not based on fraudulent and all kinds of lies, fraudulent assumptions and lies, in order to make peace possible. Maybe some Palestinians eventually will start saying, well, we cannot keep dreaming about reconquering Tel Aviv. It's, we have to adopt some other approach. And this is the message they are getting from their friends in the Arab world. Adopt a different approach. So now it's not only the United States through recognizing Jerusalem as a capital, moving the embassy, cutting aid to the Palestinians because they pay salaries to terrorists, and then so many other moves that accepting that the settlements are not illegal per se, and so on and so forth, and actually saying this is not a Palestinian land, the Palestinian occupied land, the land that Israel took in 67. These are disputed lands that Israel has a very strong claim for. It's, these are all messages delivered to the Palestinians in order to make them realize that they are defending a lost case. But it was not enough. Now with the UAE doing that, and especially if Saudi Arabia joins in, this is the big prize. But look, the Egyptians are not against it. They are in favor of that. It's, so many Arabs speak in favor of this move. So many Arabs are telling the Palestinians, listen, you have to change. You have to change your attitude. So there is a chance, small one, remote one, it's not going to happen overnight, but there is a chance that they will eventually say to themselves, okay, so let's think it over, and maybe we will have to adopt a new policy. The chance that this is going to happen are going to rise considerably if Trump wins, but I think if Biden wins, they are going to continue with their own old approach, but who knows? I don't know what's going to happen in the United States, and I think nobody knows. Just last couple of words about the regional impact of what happened. As I said, the UAE did it not only because of our blue eyes, and we don't even have blue eyes. So it's the reason they did it was that they wanted to strengthen the pragmatic camp that they lead in its confrontation with the radical. Both, for them, by the way, it is more important to face the Muslim Sunni radicals, especially the Muslim Brotherhood. These are the real enemies they focus on, because the UAE has a very complicated relations with Iran. But the Muslim Brotherhood, you say Muslim Brothers to a UAE person, and he's immediately totally irritated, especially if you mention Erdogan or Qatar. You shouldn't mention them to them. So it's here they believe that they will be stronger in confronting these. And Iran, of course, Iran as well is a major threat for them. And they believe that Israel is a force that will help them a lot in confronting the Iranians. And I think they have some sound logic in that, because that's what we do most of the time, we fight the Iranians. I think they believe that Israel joining the pragmatic camp is one thing that's going to improve their capabilities to fight in those variety of arenas where they fight the radicals, and will also improve their situation in Washington itself. They did something great for the administration, for not only for this administration, for the United States. Everybody in the United States, I hope so, is in favor of normalization between Israel and the Arab world. So they did something big for the United States, and they expect to get something in return. So of course, first and foremost, they want some military goodies, and the F-35 is something they have their eyes on. Even if this doesn't happen, or it is coming in with a reduced capability or whatever, they are going to get something that is important. In return for that, and their position in the United States as somebody who should be compensated for the courageous move they took is I can say that it's almost guaranteed. So it's a good move for the pragmatist. Now, of course, much depends on what's going to happen on November 3rd, but because the attitude of the old Obama regime, I don't know to what extent this is true, it's going to be true with Biden, But the old Obama regime was clearly against the pragmatists and favoring the radicals, especially the sophisticated, the realistic radicals, of course, not the ultra-radicals like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but Rouhani and Zarif in Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey and Qatar, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, when they were still forced to reckon with. These were the cup of tea of the former administration. So I don't know how this is going to play out after the elections, but we shall see. But the Emiratis believe that this is going to help them regardless of who's going to be elected in the United States. They hope at least so. And so this is a major development. All in all, it's a game changer on all these, on the Palestinian side, on the Israeli-Arab relations, and on the pragmatic camp posture vis-a-vis its enemies. And this is, by the way, the reason why Turkey and the Iranians are scratching their heads and cursing everybody around, because they are really disturbed and frustrated with what happened. So it's a big move. It's a big move, a big important move. And how, to what extent is it going to be important depends on us, on America and on Israel. Are we going to make it clear that it pays off to be our friend? And the Russians are very good at that. Israel, so-so. The Americans, quite bad. So let's see if we can come up to the challenge. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a great place to stop. We have a lot of questions. Let me just say to people who sent questions, if your question contains the word election, America, Biden, or Trump, we're not taking it, okay? We don't do electoral politics. Thank you for the question, but it's just going to sit there. So you mentioned, Yossi, at the end, Turkey and Iran scratching their heads and being unhappy. How unhappy are they? Do they see this as a political problem, or do they see this as potentially, particularly in the case of Iran, a military problem?
Well, I think, especially in the case of Iran, less so in the case of Turkey, but not totally not in the case of Turkey, because Turkey is in a situation where it can face the UAE on the battlefield as well, both in Libya and maybe also in the context of the conflict they have with Greece and in other places as well. But first of all, I'd say Iran is concerned that it will play out also in the context of a military confrontation. They realize that UAE is much closer to Iran than Israel. And it's, it has an effect on the capabilities of Israel to collect information. It has an impact on the capability of Israel to carry out of all kinds of military moves that it might want to carry out. So they definitely look at that from this angle. And some Iranian said, every move that Israel is going to make against us, we shall consider it as if the UAE did it against us. They're trying to deter the UAE. I don't think that plays very well in Dubai. But they are afraid from the military consequences of something like that, not just from the other issue. Now, there's no direct battle right now between the UAE and the Iranians, with maybe the exception of Yemen through proxies, because the Emiratis moved away, and so they're not involved directly. But they realize that even in a place like Yemen, if Israel decides for some reason to get more involved in helping with intelligence and things like that, we are a regional military power, or maybe even a superpower. We enjoy, vis-a-vis Iran, what everybody would like to enjoy, which is intelligence dominance. We know what we need to know on time. That's something that's extremely important. Nobody else has it. I'm not even sure about the United States. Because if I look at what happened in Saudi Arabia exactly a year ago with the attacks on Aramco, somebody didn't know that something like that is coming. I'm not sure that we can solve problems there, but we at least, I guess, know how to handle this matter. We cannot guarantee anybody full coverage, but if we shall be able to make it more difficult for the Iranians to threaten oil facilities in the Persian Gulf, it's a major change in the equilibrium between of the balance between them and the Gulf countries, because right now these countries are extremely vulnerable, as was shown last year. This is a major change, I think.
So you mentioned that Israelis all have friends in the UAE, and that's the way that works. So when you look at intelligence cooperation or military cooperation, potential military cooperation, is this something that needs to get started now, or is this something that's been working its way up the system for a while?
No, it was already working up the system for a while, of course. As you know, we don't cooperate on intelligence only with countries we have formal diplomatic relations with. But that said, the level of cooperation can go up considerably. And because there are all kinds of things that you do and all kinds of things you don't do when you have relations, diplomatic relations, or you don't. And I think that it's going to improve dramatically.
Great. Let's consider the Europeans for a moment, specifically the EU. We have two questions involved here. One is, how are they responding? Do they see it as a setback for their position, which has always been the land for peace position, the Israeli withdrawal position? And secondly, we saw last week that the EU threatens Serbia, that if it opened an embassy in Jerusalem, it wouldn't be able to go forward with EU membership because no EU member has an embassy in Jerusalem. So are the Europeans sticking their fingers where they don't belong? Are they congratulating Israel and the UAE? What are they doing these days?
Well, they are congratulating Israel and the UAE on the move, but it is such a cold congratulation. It's hard to accept it as a real congratulation. It's amazing. They definitely, they are frustrated. I mean, this leaves them. It's so strange. The Arabs are telling the Palestinians to change, and the Europeans are the only people on earth that are telling the Palestinians, don't change. Stick to this old paradigm that doesn't work. Continue to suffer. We shall give you money. Don't worry. We shall give you money, but just don't change. And it is beyond, you know, I once sat with the ambassador of the EU in Israel, and I told him, we were friends, and I told him, can you show me where is your money going to? You invest in Israel, give all kinds of donations to all kinds of, and he showed me that it was really amazing. I told him, listen, this is really ridiculous. All your money goes on groups that have no impact in Israel. It's all these extreme left. Why do you waste your money? Don't you understand you're on the wrong side of where the things are going? And they like to be there. Look, they spend so much money on organizations that are actually BDS organizations, and spend so much money on organizations, those BDS organizations that are actually affiliated with terror groups. And when they, just according to formality, where they approach these organizations, tell them, listen, we, according to our rules, we cannot give you money if you give it to people who are actually part of a terror organization. So all these groups, 130 groups, said, no, we are not going to accept this condition. We don't call them terror organizations, and we insist that we should not adopt this rule. And what did the EU did? Instead of insisting that this is not going to be the case, they said, okay, we'll give you an exemption. That's ridiculous. That's where the EU is, and that coming back to the issue of Serbia and Kosovo, it's amazing. It's amazing. I mean, you don't want to accept Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Fine. It's crazy. It's very strange. Maybe we should put our embassy in London instead of in the UK instead of London. Maybe we should put it in Leeds. I don't know. who would accept something like that? But to tell somebody else what to do, it's and this is the condition for being accepted into the EU. This is so ridiculous. That's where the Europeans are. It's a very, I don't know. But this is small money. This is small money. And forget about Jerusalem. The fact that they side with the Iranians against the United States and insist on letting the Iranians move towards having a nuclear weapon arsenal with missiles that can hit Europe, while the Iranians boast in their capability to launch missiles with nuclear weapons to Europe. And nevertheless, they stand with Iran against the United States. This is beyond my understanding. They just hate the United States under Trump so much that they will side with Iran against it.
Well, they do, and they don't care much for you either. So
no, we don't build anything on them. So we're not frustrated. But the United States needed the EU on that issue. They couldn't get their support.
Yep. Yes, our best friends, the British, the French, supposed to be our friends.
With friends like that.
Yeah, right. We'll look for other friends. On the question of the application of sovereignty in the West Bank. So Bibi made a speech after the announcement of the accord with the UAE in which he said, this was not a land for peace deal. This is a peace for peace deal. And I've always said, he was saying, peace for peace is the way to go. But at the end of the day, here's the question. Isn't it still a land for peace deal because it forces Israel, at least for the moment, not to move forward with sovereignty and secure borders?
No, because we were not able to do that anyhow. It's not because of the we don't extend the sovereignty because of the agreement. It has nothing to do with the agreement. We were not able to extend sovereignty because of the U.S. administration approach. It was them that decided not to support the move. Why? Nobody knows, but many reasons can be used in order to explain it. But they decided not to allow us to move forward, and without the U.S. support, we cannot do it. So maybe because Trump was losing approval rates in the States, maybe because he was upset that some strange people in Israel were speaking against it from the right wing, and he was worried that this is going to affect the support of his own base. Maybe because he was unhappy with the fact that Israel doesn't have a full political support for that, and that the blue and white were not totally supportive of it. They support the idea, but not the timing and not the way it's going to be implemented and so on. So, and of course, he was not happy with the Jordanian reaction and with the European reaction and with, the Palestinian reaction. But I would say most of these things were expected in advance. These were not a big surprise. Maybe with the exception of the attitude of some of the settlers, everything else was to be expected. So when they gave the green line in the beginning, they should have known what to expect. Nevertheless, things have changed. And the one other thing that was not expected was that Corona came and all kinds of things happened that took the attention away from the Israeli moves and had to be dealt with in a more urgent manner. So anyhow, we couldn't do it. And that's why this was not something we gave to the UAE. If the UAE want to say that they were giving it, let them boast in it. I don't have any problem with that. For them, it's a good excuse vis-a-vis the Palestinians to say, we saved you and you criticize us. Okay, but those who saved them were the Americans, in fact. And that is
so internally, though, if Bibi was at an impasse with the president and the application of sovereignty wasn't going to happen, how big a political deal is this for him? That is this a big win, the UAE? Does this really help his position?
Because of all the reasons I mentioned before, we want a strong, pragmatic camp. We want to be integrated into the region. We want the Palestinians to feel that they don't have bargaining clips for bargaining chips for forcing their ideas upon us, and that they will have to change their attitude so that we shall have real peace with the Palestinians. We want peace with them. And this is very good for the chances of peace. So from all these, and also internally, I think people are happy that Bibi made this happen. So it's, I think for Israel, I don't know about Bibi, but for Israel, it's a good move. And if it's a good move, and the prime minister at the time of such a good move is Bibi, so it's probably also a good move for him. And he didn't pay a real price. He paid a price with something that was not his. He couldn't, he didn't have the application of sovereignty available for him. So he paid the price. The other questionable issue is the issue of the F-35, on which is, Israel opposes the idea of sending them. And now the new line that you hear from Jerusalem is that we count on President Trump to make the right decision that will take into account Israel's security. Okay, I don't know what that means. We count on President Trump. Anyhow, what can you do? But the prices are at the end of the day, you can't have a free lunch, right? That's you got to pay something. It's also true for the UAE, as I said before. It's also true for us. We cannot have something for nothing. And so we have to pay something. We didn't pay on sovereignty because we didn't have sovereignty. And what's going to happen in the next 4 years, we shall see. If Biden is elected, this issue is not going to be discussed. If probably. But if Trump is going to be elected, this issue is going to be discussed. I don't know what are going to be the results of the discussion, but it's definitely going to be discussed in the next 4 years. And there are, just as I said before, that there are all kinds of partial normalization that we can live with. We don't need everybody to have full diplomatic relations and open an embassy in Jerusalem. Then there's also partial application of the sovereignty. We can do all kinds of in between, all kinds of things in between, like have more construction in this area, move forward in preparing the infrastructure for the implementation of the Trump plan, like building all the intersections that have to be built in order to allow this strange tiger-like leopard situation be feasible. So we have to buy, to build all kinds of intersections that will allow roads to go up and down. And there's a lot of things that we can do. We can even, my suggestion would be that we shall adopt the Edmund Levy report. I don't know if you, this is not for class one, this is for class three. But this is a report that was prepared some 8 years ago and was prepared for the government by a committee led by Judge Edmund Levy from the Supreme Court that looked at the situation of the ownership of land in the Judean Samaria territory. And came up with all kinds of solutions that, because it was not discussed by the government in the last 8 years, we suffer from all kinds of problems in the territories. And this report can solve many of the problems without dealing with the question of sovereignty.
So as we're speaking, a very large thunderstorm with a lot of lightning has just arrived on the top of my house. And I'm afraid that we're going to get knocked off the air here in a minute. So, and in any event, we've come to the end of our program. So let me ask you a short question to close while I still have connectivity on my computer and my roof is still attached to my house. Clearly, it's the intention of Israel and the UAE to bring further partners into this. Some of them will be formal partners. Some of them will be, like Saudi Arabia for the moment, an informal partner where Israel gets certain benefits, but maybe they don't sign a peace treaty. Okay. If you were picking, who would you say are the next countries that are likely to enter a formal agreement with Israel? Who's hot?
Well, I think the Sudan is the hottest, but the Sudan is ready to do that. The current leadership is ready to do that, but they have some legal obstacles because they are an interim regime. So they have some problems with how far they can go legally. But if it was up to them, they would do that. They do it because they need it. They need our support in Washington, and much of it is going to Washington through Tel Aviv. And I just wrote an article a couple of months ago about the need for the United States to take Sudan off the list of terror states and to resume aid to the Sudan. And I think that this is the right thing to do. And so I think that Sudan would have been the first one, but because of the problems, it might be losing this race to Bahrain, which is also close to accepting it. Although it's for the Bahrainis, it's more complicated. I think everybody here looks at Saudi Arabia. And I think that the two last moves of Saudi Arabia, allowing Israeli planes to fly to Abu Dhabi through Saudi airspace, and yesterday allowing Israeli planes to fly to the east over Saudi airspace without any restrictions. These are clear signs to everybody. Listen, we are in favor of that. We have some limitations of how far we can go, but we are in favor of that. So if any of you want to move, don't feel that you need to ask too many questions. Go ahead. And I think Oman, Bahrain, Sudan are listening. And who's going to be the first? Is it, I don't want somebody who's going to be upset with me in the end.
Okay, but that's a very positive note. I like to end these conversations on a positive note. I hate to leave people feeling like, you know, the sky is falling. So on that note, which is positive, I want to thank you on behalf of all the people that tuned in today, and also all the people who will listen to this podcast on our website. As our listeners know, this will be available on the website. Tell your friends, tell them it's definitely a worthwhile way to spend their lunch hour listening to today's program. Yossi, thank you very much for a great program. And thank you all for listening.
And thank you, everybody, for listening.